If you try to bite off all of this, or you try to be like, oh my God, I'm going to live like an Amish person now, like, you know, it's probably going to fail, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's a probably drastic change.
You know, I think that's really important, JR, is like having an experience in your life of change in any way. It's so inspiring because it teaches you that you have the power to change even more.
I'm J.R. Jameson. Today on The Facing Project, I sit down with Julio Vincent Gambuto, author of Please Unsubscribe Thanks, a book about taking back our time, attention, and purpose in a post-pandemic world. We'll also explore his feature film, Team Marco, that follows the life of a boy who's always plugged in until his grandpa makes him play outside. Stay with us. You're listening to The Facing Project with J.R. Jameson, and this season, I'm doing something a little different to mix up the format. I'll still share stories from past Facing Projects to shine a light on specific topics and issues, but also I'll sit down for long-form interviews with business executives, best-selling authors, filmmakers, and other artists who are using their platforms to make the world a more understanding and empathetic place, asking each of them the same question. How do we create a more empathetic world in a time when listening has decreased and each person's message is competing with millions of others? Today's guest is Julio Vincent Gambuto, who did something unthinkable in April of 2020. It was just 2 months into the pandemic, and most people were plugged in more than ever before, streaming Netflix and Hulu, doom scrolling on their phones, and watching living room concerts. I'm sure I don't have to remind you of this time. We all lived it. But you know what Julio did? He actually unplugged all of his devices and went analog in a digital world. 4 years later, he's still living mostly offline, but using technology when he's guiding it for his purposes and not the other way around. Julio Vincent Gambuto, author of Please Unsubscribe Thanks, How to Take Back Our Time, Attention, and Purpose in a World Designed to Bury Us in Bull. Thank you for joining me on The Facing Project.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I love the title of the book, by the way. It's fun and playful, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation and diving deep into your work. But first, I want to start with the Medium essay titled Prepare for the Ultimate Gaslighting that you penned in April of 2020. It went viral, and we reached 21 million readers and was the inspiration behind your book, Please Unsubscribe Thanks. While 2020 was only 4 years ago, in some ways that feels like a lifetime ago. Take us back to that moment and why you wrote this piece and ultimately the book.
Sure. It was an intense time, obviously, for everyone around the world. In New York, it was particularly intense. I'll use the word again. Because we were just on top of each other, right? I was living in a 400 square foot apartment and things are dense there. And so it's here, I should say. And I wrote the essay because we had had a particularly difficult week that week in our extended family and sort of family friend circle. So we knew about five people who had lost their lives. And in the weeks between when the emergency started and the top of April. And that particular day, we had gotten news the night before of someone else who had passed away from COVID. So it was just dark, and it was a real moment, I think, where we were all feeling depressed and devastated and couldn't figure out what this was, you know, and where it was going. Obviously, by that time, we knew what it was medically, but we didn't sort of understand the ramifications, I think, for society of the moment. Anyway, the next morning I woke up and I got this email from J. Crew. And it was like, hey, 40% off on sweaters. And I was just incensed because, you know, a few weeks prior, all of the big brands had emailed and were kind of in it with us, right? They were all emailing out to all of their subscriber lists to say, hey, we get that there's a crisis and this is how you wash your hands, America, left, right, soap, water, right? Mm-hmm. But now it was only, you know, a week or two later, and it was just like back to business as usual. And I was just so angry in the moment at what was happening in the political landscape, what was happening, you know, in New York City, directly, locally, and what was happening around the world. And this was just, to me, the most insensitive thing that you could have done in that moment. And so I wrote this essay that was, you know, part warning to be cautious to, you know, for all of us that, you know, hey, when we get back to normal, whether that's tomorrow or next week or 3 years from now, let's remember that, you know, there's going to be, or let's be aware at least, that there's going to be this influx, this inundation of brand messages and advertising messages and this push to get back to spending and running around like crazy and not eating dinner with your family and clicking and sort of getting back to the madness of it all. And, you know, it was really a call to say, hey, what are we learning about ourselves now? What are we learning about society now? And how do we want to take those lessons forward whenever this moment passes? And obviously it, you know, it hit a nerve.
Yeah. I remember that time, April of 2020, it seemed like offices were sending messages to employees about, hopefully we can come back a couple weeks from now, looking at the surge in numbers and all of that. I was working in an office environment at the time, and I remember getting an email that said, we may be back here the first week of May, right? Just this optimistic thinking of this worldwide pandemic is happening, but yet somehow it will just take a couple weeks for us to get over and get back. And it falls right into everything you talk about, that rush of wanting to get back to normal and how we're afraid as humans of being taken out of our normal everyday lives. We want that normality there all the time. And the essay you also wrote, it is very easy to close your eyes to a problem when you barely have enough time to close them to sleep. The greatest misconception among us, which causes deep and painful social and political tension every day in this country, is that we somehow don't care about each other. White people don't care about the problems of Black America. Men don't care about women's rights. Cops don't care about the communities they serve. Humans don't care about the environment. These couldn't be further from the truth. We do care. We just don't have the time to do anything about it. Maybe that's just me, but maybe it's you too. After I read that, I was like, yeah. Me too, right? Like, I remember that time, and I think I still live and feel some of that in this present day as we've gotten back to normal, as people like to say. I do a ton of work in Europe and West Asia, and when I'm over there, I don't feel this same pressure to be overly busy, to overly produce. You know, we take coffee breaks in the middle of the day. Like, people I'm working with, they'll say, hey, let's go grab a coffee. And that coffee breaks like 3 hours. And then they're like, okay, well, let's go back. Right? Like, we don't do this as Americans. What is it about us? What do you think it is about us as Americans that we want to be busy all the time?
I think a lot of our systems have been designed this way, have been designed for this maximum productivity, maximum output. We, you know, the history of our country is such that it's only the last, you know, from World War II on to now, that we really become this powerhouse economically in the world. And I think in some ways we're still young in the sense of we still sort of behave like a teenager. Like, yeah. if the country were at age, it would be like 14 or 15, right? Yeah. It's like
we're still developing.
There's a burst of energy, but we kind of haven't like settled into understanding the proportions of time that give us the right amount of joy in our lives, or ritual in our lives, or ceremony in our lives, or any of the above. And I think, you know, without putting myself up for attack here, like, Europeans just do it better in some ways, right? It's like, it's, you know, my fiance is from Montenegro in Southern Europe, and yeah, they work from 8 to 4. They have, you know, they have a lunch break in that time, but then they also go out for a coffee for an hour, hour and a half, whatever it is. And granted, it's different in every industry. It's different across. Mm-hmm. but the general vibe is that we work ourselves in America down to the bone. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because the opportunity is so big here, right? Like, oh my gosh, like I really could become a millionaire, a billionaire, right? Mm-hmm. I really could rise from being born working class to, you know, to elevating myself socioeconomically. Like, so that opportunity, which is an incredible thing, is also a lot of pressure. And, you know, and don't forget, that's also an individual perspective. Collectively, as a nation, like these systems have been designed this way, and the systems don't allow for things like universal healthcare. They don't allow for things like, you know, paid family leave. They don't allow for, in some cases, more than 2 weeks vacation for some Americans. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we work really hard because we have to here in some ways, because in other civilized democracies, you know, some of these things are paid for. So I think there's a lot of different reasons that is the case. But certainly with digital technology underlining all of it now, all of those reasons have been kind of aggravated.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're available always in today's time, right? I mean, so many ways to be reached, which you talk about so eloquently in your book. And that busyness, as you talked about in the essay, does take us away from really major societal issues that we should be putting our attention on. But when we look at an individualistic perspective, I fall into this trap where I think, yeah, I want to go to that march tomorrow, but I also have this, 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 and this I need to do. And I know there will be 100 people there. So what's one more, right? Like we fall into these traps all the time, and it's really terrifying. And what I did appreciate about the pandemic, and you talk about in your essay in your book, was the opportunity for the great pause. Or AKA the circus, which I love that you so affectionately call it, being a wake-up call to us as Americans. And it was a time for us to reset ourselves. And I think many of us do have stories about how we reset ourselves during that time. I know for me personally, it was trying to assess what brings me joy, Marie Kondoing my life, as you say, and determining what I wanted to get rid of and what I could keep in my life. And sometimes that was work. Sometimes that was people, which you talk about too in your book. Who are the people who are actually taking too much of your time and bringing you down? We can't be everybody's psychologist, right? We can't. So I started examining that closely in my own life. But now that we're 3-4 years from 2020, I find that I'm slowly slipping back into my old self, and I see other people doing it too. Have we as a society forgotten about the Great Awakening? Did we fall into the gaslighting? What do you say to that?
I think yes and no, right? I think that we have, there are certainly certain lessons that we can't not take forward. I think many of us have learned them in our homes. Many of us have learned them in our schools. We've taken action to ensure that the future is different by making changes and committing to changes. But in many ways, we haven't taken too much action. Mm-hmm. In many ways, we are sliding back to that, if you will. I think the word gaslighting is somewhat provocative and might be off-putting for people. In the sense that nobody wants to feel like they've been manipulated. Nobody wants to feel like they have been somehow coerced into doing something that they you know, otherwise would not want to, or that they would want to. So I think when you look at where we are now, I think we have reverted to a lot of the same behaviors because we're still committed to a lot of the underlying beliefs that run those behaviors. So from a psychological perspective, you know, for example, look at it, you can look at it individually and then collectively. Individually, you know, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to go in the office anymore. That's it. I'm done. Forget it. And now suddenly everybody else is going back into the office, right? Mm-hmm. And then suddenly the world has shifted, quote unquote, back. But we've been able to say, okay, we're going to carve out Monday and Friday, or we're going to carve out 2 days a week where I don't have to be in the office. And in some ways, that pendulum is sort of now settling in a new place. It's not fully the place we perhaps discovered we wanted to go. Oh my gosh, I want to work from home 5 days a week. That's it. Mm-hmm. I no longer believe it's possible, you know, that I need to be in the office. And now we've sort of, you know, settled into a middle ground that might be productive and yet a little less pressure. Mm-hmm. But I think, if you look at it collectively, I think DEI is a good example, right? Suddenly, in the beginning after 2020, it was unquestionable that you had to hire a DEI officer. You had to make sure that your organization was looking through a new lens, that we had learned something, right? We had learned something by millions of people across the world marching in the streets, and we had been awakened, and now we had to make changes at an organizational level. It makes me really sad that momentum is waning now, and you're seeing a lot of reports of people disbanding their DEI teams or limiting the scope of what they can do within an organization. And I think the reason for that is that we haven't necessarily interrogated the underlying belief that got us there in the first place, right? Mm. And the underlying belief is that, there needs to be more equity in this system. You can't necessarily just hire someone, put a hat on them, and tell them to, preach the gospel of diversity, equity, inclusion, without doing the deep work of making changes at a much deeper level within an organization. So without getting too much in the weeds, to answer your question, I think the answer is yes and no. In many ways, we have been making changes and learning lessons and putting those into effect. And in other ways, we're kind of losing our confidence to be bold about that. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to write this book because I wanted it to be a reminder to us that this is how we felt a few years ago.
Yeah.
Let's revisit that. Let's stay present to it. Let's extend that awakening as far into the future as we can, because we're going to need it in an age of AI, in an age of automation. We're going to need the lessons we learned in the pandemic to help better the future.
Do you think it's generational as far as wanting to get back to normal, getting back to the office? Do you find that older generations want to get back to the way things were before March of 2020, and the younger generation, right? Like they've adapted to the way things were and they don't want to go back. Do you see that being generational, or does it not really matter?
Yeah, I wish I had the data on that, and I don't. I think just anecdotally what I have heard, especially with respect to the book or in response to the book, has been that some folks who are my parents' generation have said I don't feel this sense of go, 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 constant. I don't feel this sense that I have to be everyone to, everything to everyone all the time, everywhere. But I think if you look, I'm 45 now. So I think if you look at my generation and below, we are the ones who entered the workforce on email. Mm-hmm. We are the ones who entered the workforce with cell phones. We are, I was class of 2000 at college, and we were the first class at my college to have an email address.
Yeah.
So that was a real cutoff line, right? Because we had spent our childhood in analog, but we were about to spend our adulthood in digital. And so we are that last kind of micro generation, if you will, that kind of had one foot in each. But we had to go full force forward into digital because we didn't have a choice. We were 22 years old and starting at companies across the country. And so I don't know if it's the desire or resistance to go back to normal that's generational, but I think the experience of the day-to-day of what work is generational, and what life feels like is generational. Everyone my generation and below feels they have to always be on all the time. And that's a really difficult and unsustainable way to live.
Yeah, I too am 45. And I remember my freshman year of college, we were the first class at the university to have an email address, as you were talking about. I didn't even know how to use it. I was like, what is this thing? Who do I email? Do I email like my professor?
Like, why would I need this?
Is there etiquette? Yeah. Like, I remember email etiquette classes and all of that, right? And so in our generation, we've seen so much change in the workforce and the way we communicate that I find sometimes I long for those days before I got that email account in the mid to late 90s, to when it was harder to reach me or anybody else. And as you said, we just continue to add more and more and more ways to connect, to communicate, all of the technology. And I think someone like my dad, who's 80 and doesn't even have a cell phone, never has, or an email account for that matter. And I just think, wow, how refreshing would that be in so many ways? Because his experience during the pandemic, right, was totally different. He was retired. He was already at home anyway, so he just kind of stayed at home and still watched TV, didn't have to worry about pinging and dinging him all day long, right? That just seems so refreshing, but also a little unrealistic to totally unplug.
Yeah, you know, I mean, plenty of people have called me out, you know, after reading the books, being like, all right, well, I don't know if I can do all that you did, but I'm going to do a little bit of this. I'm going to unsubscribe in a few different ways. I'm going to take your advice or your suggestions in these minor ways and see how that works for me and go forward. But I, you know, why I wrote the book is I went kind of full throttle and I just went off of everything. I was off social media for 6 months. I didn't turn the TV. I literally unplugged the TV in my house and only plugged it in for the news at night and then unplugged it. I unplugged the Wi-Fi. I just found every opportunity to step back. And I think it's important, JR, to communicate this, which is, I'm not advocating that people give these things up and never go back to them. That I'm not advocating that they have no value. I'm not advocating that they don't have any benefit to us. They have all of those things. Mm-hmm. But we've got to be able to build in to this system moments of reflection, moments of stepping back, periods and chapters of our life and our work life and our day-to-day where we're able to turn off and not always be on, and really evaluate what is all of this giving us or allowing us to do, and what is it keeping us from? Mm-hmm. And I found in my life, it was keeping me from a lot, right? I was on autopilot, going. And when you're on autopilot like that, you don't have a lot of room in your life for the things that are missing. And for me personally, that was love. It was a romantic relationship. I couldn't find the space for it because I was simply oversubscribed. And that doesn't mean I had, you know, oh, you have a Netflix subscription. That's why you don't have a boyfriend. No, what I mean is that my entire life, you know, was tethered. I was always tethered to some sort of commitment that was making other people happy, rich, et cetera, et cetera. And those weren't necessarily making me any of those things.
Yeah.
And so I had to really kind of cut the tethers around me and step back. Mm-hmm. And so it's the stepping back that the book is really about. It's the act and the practice of not being always on so that you can really understand, you know, where in this system is there value for me and to my life? Where do I want to plug in? Where do I want to be tethered? And kind of allow yourself to get rid of the rest.
Mm-hmm. And I appreciated that so much about the book. There's one part where you mention your friend's home and how it lights up like the East River on the 4th of July every time the phone rings. And I actually laughed out loud when I read that because that's my reality. That is seriously my house. We have two TVs. We have a small 1,200 square foot home. It's not huge. We have a TV in the living room and a TV in our bedroom, and they are always on. They've been on for probably a decade. We never turn them off. Even when we leave the house, the TVs are still going. It's just that's how we live our lives. And most of the time, it's on the news. And so one thing I did do from your book is my husband and I agreed to turn off our TVs, and we have, and it's so weird, first of all, to be in the living room, and it's so quiet. It's like, what in the world? I can hear like a humming of like the world humming, or maybe my house. I don't know, but I've never noticed it. So that quietness is a little weird at first, and we have agreed to only turn the TV on in the evenings. Sometimes we still do watch the news because we want to be up to date on what's happening, but most of the time we are turning to the Discovery Channel or National Geographic to kind of just get us away from the anxiousness of the world. And I have felt like my anxiety has dropped by doing that. I do miss sometimes constantly having that background noise going because I got so used to doing it all of the time. But my anxiety has dropped. Can you talk a bit about when you started to unplug during this time? How did it improve your mental health, if it did? And also, what did others around you say, or how did they do? How did they adapt to the new Julio?
Great question. The best way for me to answer that is to talk about the quiet. The quiet is the thing I think we as a society have grown very scared of. The quiet is so unnerving to us because the noise has been so intense for the last two decades. Mm-hmm. And it makes us on edge when we have to wrestle with the quiet or wrestle with things that are uncomfortable or wrestle with disappointment or wrestle with grief or any of the things that are a part of the human experience that this new way of being as a society, a digital, fully automated subscriber society, doesn't allow the time and space for. And that to me is the value of stepping back and creating that quiet, what I call in the book kind of a sacred space, mm-hmm. because I think our humanity is in that quiet and our authentic selves are in that quiet. And I'm not suggesting live like a monk. I'm not suggesting, live like the Amish. I'm not suggesting any of those things. Mm-hmm. But I have found, to your question, that my mental health has gotten so much better in the last few years as a result of that quiet, because it has allowed me to, very much to the point of your show, to face myself, to confront the things that are too easy to run away from. And the society as it's now designed gives you every opportunity in the world to run away, every opportunity in the world to push off and not deal, bury something in the noise. It's so easy now to do those things that if we want to confront our own humanity, we have to be willing to find the quiet. And so I've seen my mental health dramatically change. To the second part of your question, yeah, a lot of people think I'm crazy. Like a lot of my friends and family think I'm nuts. Like my sister is like, when is this new phone going to end? Because I have a phone that's created for and marketed to senior citizens.
A jitterbug, right? Is that what it's called?
I have a jitterbug phone. I got rid of my iPhone. I have this jitterbug phone, and it has limited apps, and it has a button I can press if I fall down and I can't get up, right? But I did it because I wanted to slow it all down, and I wanted to be less always on. And the response is always shock and horror, right? I went into a restaurant once, actually while I was writing the book, and I didn't take my phone with me. And I was meeting a friend, and the restaurant was pretty big. And I said to the server, the host person, I'm here for lunch with a friend. And she said, okay, can you just text them and find out where they are? And I was like, I'm sorry, I don't have my phone with me. And she looked at me like I had committed the gravest social sin, right? Because and she said, oh, you're giving me so much anxiety.
Oh my gosh.
I said, well, I'm sorry if I'm getting you anxiety, but my anxiety is much, much lower. because I'm kind of out in the analog wild, and I feel freer And so that has been the response, right? From waitresses, mm-hmm. from my sister, from all sorts of people in my life who have said, like, how are you doing this? How do you find anywhere? How do you mm-hmm. keep in touch with the world? How do you work? How do you do? And the answer is that, like, I still do the things I have to do when I sort of tap in and use these tools as I need to, but mm-hmm. I'm using them now. They're not using me, which I think is a really important distinction.
Mm-hmm. As a fellow author, as I read your book and know your current lifestyle, how you live your life unplugged, I was thinking about just upcoming book releases and the pre-sales, the release, Barnes & Noble's running their 50% off sales and needing to amplify that message. I mean, for people who are not in author land, there's just so much marketing and publicity that authors do. How did limiting time on socials and the internet impact promoting your book? And how did your team respond?
Well, it has been a challenge. I will tell you that. It's been really hard because I said to the publication team, like, I'm not necessarily going to be always on and be everywhere. It's not the way I live my life anymore. And that's why I wrote the book. So it would feel antithetical to the ethos and the purpose for me to be doing that. But we had to kind of reach like a happy middle ground, right? Which is that a lot of other people besides me on their team have put a lot of hard work into this book. And it's important that I do get out there and shout about it as much as I can. I think the message is important. I think the practices and the strategies that are in the book are really important. This illuminates another point, JR, which is that, you know, this is all going to look very different for everybody. We all have very different lives. We all have very different priorities. We have different mm-hmm. responsibilities. So my advocacy in the book is not that you do X, Y, and Z specifically, but rather that we look and we do two things, that we slow it all down mm-hmm. and that we put limits back in. Because those are the two things that have really changed, especially from the world that you and I grew up in and then were released in after college. It's suddenly this digital world has sped things up and taken away the limits. And so if you can't do or don't want to do the specific things that I've done or that I suggest in the book, my counsel to people, my urging, my call to them is just slow it down and find opportunities to slow it down and find opportunities to put limits back in. Mm-hmm. And if you can look at those as principles of unsubscription, if you can look at those as sort of guiding principles for behavior, I think that can be helpful to people who are not necessarily, you know, willing to get a new cell phone or to abandon Wi-Fi in their home or any of these things. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But the book has been very difficult to promote. Yes. Because of that. So we just made a deal that I would go on 2 days a week.
Yeah.
So I would be on social media 2 days a week. I would be on full throttle while I'm on, but I would go on 2 days a week and I post about the book and I post about the book tour and I post about, you know, helpful things for folks who are looking for new strategies to do this. And so, you know, my social media is my social media. It's one part of promoting the book and talking about it, but I don't let it overwhelm my calendar.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't have it on my phone, which is really helpful because that means that, like, I promote the book and I do my work, quote unquote, when I'm at my desk on my laptop. Mm-hmm. And so I interact with Facebook and with Instagram and all of that on my laptop so that at 6 o'clock I can close that laptop as opposed to sort of scrolling at 11 mm-hmm. o'clock at night when I'm in bed and being like, oh my God, I have to promote the book now while I'm sleeping.
Right? Yeah. I love that so much because I feel like, I mean, I'm toggled to my phone. It's constantly in my pocket, in my hand, on the table right in front of me where I'm sitting. And I really want to get there where you are. I just can't imagine doing it. But that constant need to check socials is real. It's an addiction. I mean, literally, I am addicted to my phone and social media, and I'm going to have to go through a detox, I think, if I got to the point that you're at. Did you have moments where you felt like you were detoxing from?
For sure. I mean, the metaphor is very apt because I have never necessarily dealt with addiction in that, in those contexts. Mm-hmm. But this has been an addiction, right? And in the sense that I couldn't, I didn't feel whole getting through the day without constantly being on. I would sit at home when I was single, scrolling and scrolling and scrolling on, you know, gay dating apps for hours and hours and hours. Mm-hmm. Or I would be on the on Instagram for hours and hours and hours, or Bumble, or, you know, and they're designed for us to be scrolling that way, right? And when you look at all of this, and especially the conversation in the book and digital capitalism in general, it's important to remember that, you know, it's not about personal flaws, right? It's mm-hmm. not my, especially the criticism I'm raising. It's not about the fact that you and I don't have the personal power to say no. Mm-hmm. What's happened is that these systems have been designed to need us to say yes, right? It's mm-hmm. not that we cannot say no. They are architected for the yes. They have, as an industry, as a company, as products, they have all been designed to remove friction, to remove pain points, to make things as seamless as possible, mm-hmm. so that we go from I want something to I have it, whether that's a physical mm-hmm. product or simply validation or simply a dopamine hit or simply feel loved because we had 15 likes on a photo within the mm-hmm. first 30 seconds, whatever that is, the system, quote unquote, has removed all of these barriers so that we have immediate access to those feelings mm-hmm. of power, of love, of lust, of pleasure, of validation, whatever they may be. And so, you know, it's really, really, really important to be aware of those things. If you want to get to that place of being able to leave the house without the phone, or being able to leave the house mm-hmm. and be offline for the weekend for work or whatever that is, right? We yeah. have to remember that this is not a personal flaw. These systems are designed that way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it requires us to be all the more strong and conscious and intentional about how we use them.
Mm-hmm. I was recommending your book this morning to a woman I was having a conversation with, and she was saying to me, which is why I brought up your book, I was like, oh, actually, I'm interviewing Julio, who wrote this book. She was venting a bit to me about how her boss kind of expects her to be on all the time. You and I are both creatives, right? So we have that a little bit in our lives, but we have also a little bit more freedom in some ways, too. She's in an office, strapped in an office pretty much all day. And then when she goes home, if her boss has a question, he'll text her, or he's working on something because he's working past normal business hours and a question comes up to him and he texts her. And she kind of feels like she can't set limits with him. What would you say to somebody who's in a 9-to-5 job, an office type environment, where they feel like they can't, they want to, but they can't really unplug in this way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the immediate answer is this is hard, right? This is hard. Mm-hmm. This is much harder than me, the solo entrepreneur writer who has a little bit more flexibility and privilege to be able to step away. But I do think it's important that we recognize that, you know, the kind of change that we're looking for in the society, the power changes that we're looking for between leadership and workers, between the wealthy and the underprivileged, between different groups, those are real and they're difficult, but we get to, in, you know, we get to put our finger on them in these individual moments. Of power, and when we struggle with power on an individual moment, on an individual level in our lives. And so I think this is an opportunity for people in the corporate environment, at the desk, in a 9-to-5, to raise their voices in ways that are respectful and that are aligned with the job and the work, but also are clear about what they need in order to get the job done well, and what they need in order for this to be an environment that they're comfortable working in. So, you know, that's going to be different in every office. It's going to be different in every relationship between someone and their superior, if you will, or their manager or their boss or their owner, however the structure is. But I think finding ways to discuss communication expectations is really important, whether that's at the beginning of a job, whether that's, oh my God, I've been here 3 years and I just got a new manager who wants to talk to me all day long. Whatever that is, we've got to find the inner strength to have conversations around communications expectations. What is it that you expect from me? What is the response time you expect from me? What are the hours you expect from me? And when the individual conversations don't work, or they don't feel like you're exercising enough power, that's when the group conversations really need to happen, right? Across the organization, with coworkers, with unions, with, you know, with just the people who sit in your cubicle next to you, whatever that might be, to say, how do we approach this in a way that's productive? And how can we have this conversation with the people that we report to? And you're going to get, you know, you're going to get varied responses, right? Some people are going to say, you're crazy. I expect you to work till midnight. I expect you, you know, I expect you to answer this email on a Saturday. I expect you to get back to me within 10 minutes. And then you've got to be able to decide if you're willing to put up with that or not. But you might also find that the other side goes, oh my gosh, I didn't even realize I emailed you at 11 o'clock at night. That's the only time I can get away from my kids to do email. I didn't mean for you to respond. I should have emailed you in the morning. Or, oh my gosh, was it really Saturday morning? Maybe I shouldn't have sent that. All I'm saying is that, you know, people will get a variety of responses to that kind of exercise of their voice. But, you know, the book is an exercise in my voice, and the book is an exercise in encouraging others to use theirs in these ways.
That's what I enjoyed so much about Please Unsubscribe Thanks, is that you do provide practical solutions for people to take back their lives. And the onus is on the individual, right, to say what is doable and not doable in my life. And even if, like, I personally haven't done some of these things that you recommend in the book, I still think they're practical applications, right?
Well, look at Marie Kondo, right? Like, I read Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, right? I didn't do everything that she said in that book, right? Like, if I did, I would still be sitting here holding pictures from when I was in seventh grade, right? Like, like, I didn't do everything, but it's, but every single thing that I did do held the promise of change for my life. And so that's really how I want people to look at this book as, look, there's 100 things in here you can do. Pick the ones that are going to work for you and the ones that are really going to hold and honor what you want your future to be, and try them.
Yeah.
And, you know, see if they work. So
what have you heard from folks who have read the book and tried some of the practices? Have you heard anything?
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I've heard some folks who say, like, oh my gosh, I'm not ready to do all of that, but I did do this one thing and it changed a lot of, you know, a lot. Or I did start leaving my phone at home when I go to lunch, or I left it at my desk when I went out to get a salad, or I did sit down with my kids and have a conversation about our expectations about phones in the house. We decided that, you know, the family room can only have this many hours of Wi-Fi or of TV or whatever it might be. So I'm thrilled when I hear stories like that, right? Because it just means to me that people have experimented and challenged themselves to try some of these things. And some of them are new and fresh and you may not have seen before. And some of them are things you've heard 14 times and should probably give a shot, give a try. I've gotten really great feedback with respect to change and people's abilities to just... You know, I think that's really important, JR, is like having an experience in your life of change in any way, whether that's, you know, in your meaning, like your personal behavior. It's so inspiring because it teaches you that you have the power to change even more. Mm-hmm. So if you try to bite off all of this, or you try to be like, oh my God, I'm going to live like an Amish person now, uh-huh. like, you know, it's probably going to fail, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's a drastic change.
Exactly. But if you start to do the things like that you're even talking about with your husband about, you know, limiting television, or mm-hmm. you start to, your body and your brain start to kind of shift, and you go, oh my gosh, like, what else can I change? What else can I do? Where else can I lower the volume, lower mm-hmm. the anxiety, lower the pinging, the ringing, the dinging, so that I can get closer connected to the people around me, the relationships I have in my life, the, you know, where I have joy and fun, and like, mm-hmm. you know, where my friends are, you know. But I've seen a great response, and I'm really happy when people tell me that they, you know, have tried things.
Yeah. I also found the book to be a good testament to relearning oneself and finding what brings joy, and then, you know, not letting that go. What brings you joy these days?
At the moment, I'm spending a lot of time with my partner, who, as of last year, is my fiance, and we read together. We have a lot of fun just kind of being in the same room with one another. Mm-hmm. And that's just not something I'm used to, right? I mean, our relationship is now on its fourth year, but 10 years before that I was single, and this has been wonderful. So he brings mm-hmm. me a lot of joy. I get a lot of joy from my nieces and nephews. I am not at every game and every cheer practice and things like that, but we spend a lot of time together, and I try to be there as much as I can. I don't know a damn thing about football. I don't know a damn, mm-hmm. but I love watching.
You're
the game.
You're in good company.
And, yeah, like, you know, I have no idea what just happened. I don't know what yard line they're on or whatever it is, but like, I'm glad that this, you know, 12-year-old, 13-year-old sees my face there cheering him on. Mm-hmm. I get a lot of joy from my relationships. I get a lot of joy. And that's what for me was missing. Mm-hmm. It was always there. I just couldn't access it. Right. I wasn't making enough space for my sisters, right? I love laughing mm-hmm. with these two women. They're incredible people. They're so fun. I was living too far away and was just too busy, and I wasn't making the space to do that. I also get a lot of joy out of fonts and typography.
Oh, really? Tell me
sounds,
more.
Sounds so weird. No, I get a lot of joy out of graphic design. I get a lot of joy out of, I don't get any joy out of cooking. I did not get that gene whatsoever. I get a lot of joy out of architecture. I get a lot of joy out of history. So, you know, we mix it up. We'll go to, you know, places and museums and read books and do things that I probably wouldn't have done before. Mm-hmm. Only in the sense that, like, I was just on this autopilot that was like, I'm working in the film business. I can only read things about film. I can only go to things that are movies. I can only, you know, mm-hmm. occupy my life with film people. I know some incredible film people, but I also know other people in my life that I love.
Yeah.
So, a lot of this effort for me has been about kind of bringing more texture back into my life, and realizing that not every friendship is a text message. Not every friendship is, to be looked at the same way. Mm-hmm. And so I'm finding much more joy now in doing things with friends that make us both happy. So instead of like maintaining my friends like a Rolodex on text message every day and making sure, you know, and like being intentional about being like, oh my gosh, this person loves to bowl. I love to bowl. Let's go bowling. This person is a foodie. They love food. I love food, and I always love food through their eyes. Let's go to a new restaurant in New York together. That to me has been a really big shift in my social life, because it means that, you know, when somebody texts me, I pick up the phone and call them. Mm-hmm. And it has just sort of like brought new energy to our friendship.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, in addition to being an author and a writer, you're also a filmmaker. Your first feature film, Team Marco, tells the story of a young boy who is constantly plugged in and obsessed with video games until his grandfather moves in and Marco's life is turned upside down when he's forced to play outside. It's a wonderful story and is available on all the major digital movie platforms. But the making of this film happened before the pandemic and before your viral essay and before the book and everything that we just talked about. Did Team Marco predict the slowing down that was to come?
Team Marco, I have always talked about as a movie about friendship and about bocce and about appreciating your Italian, or I should say appreciating your background, no matter what it is. And then as soon as the pandemic hit, and as soon as I started engaging in writing this book, I realized, oh my God, I made a movie about technology and technology use and about the compromise we all have to come to between tradition and modernity and between technology and more physical forms of play. And so I don't know if it predicted the slowdown, but it certainly predicted, I mean, like personally, artistically, creatively, like in my life, and there's definitely a thread there for sure. But yeah, I think it also gave me another opportunity to work with young people and to literally be on set every day for 5 or 6 weeks with, you know, people in their, you know, 15 and below. And so I got to see how they interact and how they form community and how they socialize. And they were totally willing and, you know, to get in a circle with me and engage physically, meaning participate in conversation and in the acting exercises that we did to prepare them for the movie. But then also, you know, after that, they would go off and make sure that they were on a group text and make sure that they could text each other when they left and make sure that they FaceTimed each other if they had a question. And so right in front of my eyes, I sort of saw young people negotiate the physical world and the digital world and find ways to put them together. And so, you know, the call in the book and the call in that movie is the same, which is in this future that we are facing, you know, how do we combine them in a way that actually betters ourselves and pushes forward our humanity and is humane and is also equitable and fair and promotes justice? But how do we do that in a way that doesn't strip us of our humanness? You know,
Sometimes the universe works in mysterious ways, doesn't it?
Very strange. Very, very. I mean, the oddest part about Team Marco was that it was a movie about technology use that then came out during the pandemic.
Right.
And we were on streaming, not in theaters, which broke my heart because we didn't have the opportunity. We had one opportunity at the Mill Valley Film Festival in 2019 to kind of have an opening and have a premiere. And then the world shut down a few months later. So, it was very strange to try to put out a movie in the middle of the pandemic.
But yeah,
we did.
Yeah. Congratulations on that. You grew up in a large Italian family from Staten Island. How much of Team Marco is autobiographical?
A lot of it, actually. So Team Marco is about a boy who is obsessed with his iPad and his grandfather, who's an older Italian man, moves into the house and kind of drags him to the bocce court to teach him about life. And the movie's about their unexpected friendship. And so, you know, I grew up with four grandparents. I was very, very lucky. I grew up knowing my four grandparents, having relationships, friendships with them. And it was a great way to grow up. It was a great way to have access to them and exposure to them and their worldview and their history and the history of the family. And so, you know, I loved that. So a lot of Team Marco was me trying to communicate creatively what was so valuable about that and what was so lovely about that and what was so beautiful about that. And I loved it. And, you know, my grandfather used to say, like, children should be seen, not heard. And like they were old, they were old school. Like, I don't want to romanticize it too much. Right. They were like super old school. And I fought with them all the time because I've always been a little loud, but it was very autobiographical in that sense, Was it autobiographical about it? You know, was I a kid who played bocce with his grandfather? Not directly. I played a lot of cards with my grandmother, but cards are not as interesting to watch on screen as, yeah, as bocce.
Very true. I was going to ask if you played bocce. It sounds like that you did, maybe growing up. Maybe you still do. I don't know. Do you still play bocce?
I do. I mean, I played a lot, certainly a lot more when we were making the movie and when we were preparing for the movie. But I live in New York now, and in a lot of the surrounding suburbs, there are just bocce courts everywhere now. Like every new development, they build a tennis court and a bocce court. And in some of the old parks, they're converting and putting bocce courts in. So there's been this strange surge in the game in the last few years here in the New York area. And it's always been a place where it was popular, but I think it's become more popular. And funny enough, like as the pandemic hit, it kind of presented a, you know, it was a game to play outside that you could be in the outdoors with family playing, you know, intergenerationally. So yeah, there was a lot of sort of fortunate overlap between the movie and real life.
I want to go back quickly to the book. Please unsubscribe. Thanks. You're also a comedian and you've created a new show based on the book. What can you tell us about that?
So, so I wrote a show called Please Unsubscribe. Thanks. That I started putting up in the fall, and I'm going to start putting up again probably this fall. The schedule is a little tentative, but it's a staged version of the book. You know, for those who have read the book, there's some comedic moments, and I like to write with as much comedy as I can. And so the show is me on stage for an hour talking about the issues that we're talking about the societal shifts that we're talking about everything from economics to history to strategies for, you know, being happier, but all through the lens of a sort of stage act and a stage show. So I spoke at South by Southwest back in March and had the opportunity to address the conference with some of that material and some of that content. And it has evolved and grown. And so it's been really, really, really fun to watch it evolve and grow. I get a real kick out of having conversations like this, but I love doing them in a theater, and I love doing them on stage. And I love when audiences will kind of audibly agree with certain things or audibly respond to certain things. There's a bit in the show about income inequality and about how we're all sort of like hanging on, right? And we're having a hard, some of us are having a harder time than others. And people will, you know, sort of will say out loud, like, yeah, that's me. You know? So I'm really enjoying that. It's an incredible way to connect with people. And so we're gonna get it back up on stage soon. I don't have a date yet, but all that will be on my website as soon as it's ready to go.
So. Awesome. What else are you working on? Anything you can share?
Sure. Well, the book is out in paperback now. It came out a few weeks ago in paperback. It's available in France and in Italy and in Brazil now. So I'm having a great time continuing to talk about it and now to put it on stage and to talk about it more. I'm working on a few screenplays, a few projects. The film business is incredibly slow. And it's been a few years of pandemic plus strike plus whatever. But this year we are sort of back in the swing of things. So there's a few projects there. And then I'm working on my next book, which is going to be sort of in the same vein, but more focused on branding and personal branding and why we all feel the need to become personal brands and what that does to the soul and what that does to our happiness and how we can kind of live in a very branded world with more balance. So, no date for that yet, but that's on my desk now. So.
I can't wait to read it. If you need an early reader, let me know.
Thanks, JR.
Yeah, absolutely. Lastly, the work we do here at The Facing Project is to create a more understanding and empathetic world. I'd love for you to add your perspective on this question. I'm actually asking all of my guests this season this same question. How do we create a more empathetic world in a time when it feels like listening and understanding the lives of others has actually decreased?
we have to get off autopilot. It's the point of my book, and I will double down on it right now with you in the context of that question, because on autopilot, we become less feeling, we become less empathetic, we become much more willing to put up with bullshit. We become much more willing to just swallow what is given to us. We lose our voice, we become less authentic, and we learn how to toe the line, obey the rules, and be quiet. And my advocacy with my book and all the work I'm doing these days is to push people to open their mouths in a kind way and in a forceful way and in a productive way to get off autopilot. Just get off this treadmill that we are on and have been on and fell off during the pandemic and may have gotten back on again. I think empathy and understanding and humanity and kindness and community are all on the other side of a transition we need to make in the society right now, where we need to kind of rebalance what the economy has done, what the digital ecosystem has done to us. And it has put us on autopilot. It has done that intentionally. It has done that with incredibly powerful tools. And I don't believe that it always honors our best and it always honors our humanity. So if empathy is the goal, which it is, right? If we're going to all get along well and survive and thrive and make this world a better place and make this world someplace we want to be in and live in and thrive in, I think we've got to exercise our power and exercise consciousness and sort of, when we find ourselves waking up a bit, stay awake and just stay present to who we are and what we are and what we want and what we want to put into the world, and stay off that treadmill, because the treadmill is easy and the treadmill is comfortable and the treadmill is smooth and the treadmill has been made, all of those things on purpose. You know, but empathy is in short order, or I should say in short quantity these days. And we need more of it. And that's my take on how to get more of it.
Julio Vincent Gambuto, author of Please Unsubscribe, Thanks, How to Take Back Our Time, Attention, and Purpose in a World Designed to Bury Us in Thank you for joining me on The Facing Project.
Thanks for having me.
More about Julio Vincent Gambuto and his work at juliovincent.com, where he never pressures you to subscribe, but you'll be thankful you did. Many thanks once again to Julio Vincent Gambuto for joining me on today's show, and to his publisher, Simon & Schuster, for providing a complimentary copy of Please Unsubscribe, Thanks, How to Take Back Our Time, Attention, and Purpose in a World Designed to Bury Us in Bullshit. To listen to past episodes of this program, visit indianapublicradio.org/thefacingproject, or find us on your favorite podcasting app, or just ask your smart speaker to play The Facing Project on NPR. To continue the conversation about this episode, find us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at The Facing Project. The Facing Project is recorded at Indiana Public Radio at Ball State University in beautiful and wonderful Muncie, Indiana. It is produced by the amazing producer and audio engineer extraordinaire, Sean Ashcraft. The show is distributed nationally through PRX. I'm your host, J.R. Jameson. And until next time, I wish you the courage to share your own story and the empathy to listen to others.